The Supreme Court has long held that it's unconstitutional for a public school teacher or administrator to lead public school children in prayer during school hours. But what about after school? What if there's a voluntary program where children go into public schools after school hours and engage in religious services or religious instructions? In a very famous case called the Good News Club case, the Supreme Court of the United States said that that kind of separated indoctrination or instruction, if you prefer, is perfectly constitutional. In fact, religious groups have the same rights of access to public buildings that all other groups have. Today, we're going to speak with a woman named Catherine Stewart, who thinks that was a very bad decision and who is determined to see it overturned. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly Constitutional, and today, it's about the Good News Club.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, produced in cooperation with James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Stuart Harris, who teaches at the Appalachian School of Law.
Recently, the Supreme Court decided yet another controversial case involving the religion clauses and free speech, and this particular one is called the Town of Greece decision, where the court said it was okay for the town of Greece, New York, to have sectarian prayers, that is, explicitly Christian prayers used to open their town meetings. This built upon an earlier decision from 1983, where the court held that it was okay for the Nebraska state legislature to open its sessions with sectarian prayers, including prayers specifically to Jesus Christ. Now, as you might guess, these decisions have both caused a great deal of controversy, and a lot's been written about them. And recently, I came across an opinion piece by a journalist named Catherine Stewart, and she did a very good job of laying out her vision of a rather strict separation between church and state, specifically as it involves a student group called the Good News Club. And as Catherine tells us, this all sprang out of a very personal experience.
My name is Catherine Stewart. I'm a journalist and author, and my latest book is called The Good News Club, and it's about the initiatives by the religious right, by religious fundamentalists, to infiltrate and undermine public education in America. And these sort of church and state issues weren't even on my radar until 2009, when I was living in Santa Barbara, California, with my family, my two kids and my husband, and I heard that a Good News Club was coming to our daughter's public elementary school. The program described itself as Bible study from a non-denominational standpoint. And I thought, great, what could be bad about, you know, a group like, called with a name like the Good News Club? What could be wrong with that?
It sounds like good news.
It sounded like good news to me. And I learned that they were, teaching Bible study from a non-denominational standpoint. And I happen to think that the Bible is worth studying even in public schools from a non-sectarian standpoint, as literature or history or, you know, comparative religions, things like that. And, I don't have a problem with that. But I started to hear stories from parents in town where Good News Clubs had been recently established. And I started to hear about how kids attending the clubs were starting to target their peers for what I could only describe as faith-based bullying and bigotry. A little girl that was the daughter of a family friend was approached on the playground by a friend of hers who had just started attending a Good News Club. The girl attending the Good News Club had figured out that this little girl that we knew, Zoe, was the only non-Christian girl in her class, and so approached her and said, "You don't believe in Jesus, so you're going to go to hell." And Zoe said, "That's not true," and things got a little heated. And the teacher heard this, exchange and decided to use it as a teachable moment. She explained that different religions have different perspectives on these different issues. So Zoe was fine with that. But the other little girl who was attending the Good News Club, she was absolutely devastated. She started to cry and she said, "How can that be? I know it must be true because I learned it in school, and they don't teach things in school that aren't true." And she was very upset about this. Now, this story gets to the heart of the trouble with Good News Clubs. I don't have a problem with kids discussing their religion with their friends at school, but I do have a problem with kids believing that a particular religion is endorsed by their school and using that false misperception to try to convert and bully their peers. Now, this was kind of astonishing experience to me, astonishing moment. It was sort of like my aha moment. I mean, this is Southern California. This area that we lived wasn't really known for its culture wars. I mean, we thought of, you know, a culture war for us meant, you know, whether you subscribe to surfing or skateboarding, that was sort of a culture war for us. But
those are the two activities of popularity in Southern California.
I know. I mean, a heated discussion was like chatting with your friends in a hot tub. It was this very idyllic community, but all of a sudden there were these needless religious conflicts that were erupting in public school playgrounds as a result of Good News Clubs being established in public schools. And, you know, I think what concerned me is that the kids attending the clubs thought that the religion of the Good News Club must be true because it was taking place on school property. And, you know, public schools have a kind of cloak of authority in the minds of very small children. They think if it happens in school, it must be what the school wants them to believe. I mean, little kids are very, you know, they're very open and they're very accepting, and they're also encouraged by their parents to view the schools as a place of authority. And so anything that happens on school property, you know, the kids assume that that must be what the school and the state want them to believe. And so I started to ask some questions about the Good News Club and its sponsoring organization, the Child Evangelism Fellowship. And
was this done, I have to ask, Catherine, was this done mm-hmm. during school hours or was it an after school activity? When did the Good News Club show up at your daughter's public school?
Good News Clubs take place after school on school property, and they target children in their first years of schooling. And they require parental permission to join. So a lot of people think that that's not a big deal. If parental permission is required to join and it's not during school hours, what's the problem? But there's a problem because children, they encourage the false misperception in very young children that their religious beliefs are endorsed by the school and by the state. You know, when it comes to young kids, the religion doesn't always fall into these very neat little categories. I reject the idea that public schools are just an open forum, and as long as adults get, you know, to proselytize after school, it doesn't create a problem. I mean, schools routinely exclude, for instance, sectarian political clubs from their property because people rightly recognize that if the young Democrats or the young Tea Partiers were meeting on school property, children would have the false misperception that those political perspectives were endorsed by the school.
Right. Now, but with regard to groups like the Good News Club and other religious groups, the court has, it, at least unless it's changed its mind quite recently, the court has said that public schools have to let all groups in on sort of an equal opportunity basis because this is essentially what we call a public forum. But you
That's
disagree
true.
With that.
The Good News Club is indeed a product of this kind of aggressive legal advocacy that is now enshrined in this crucial Supreme Court decision called Good News Club versus Milford Central School. Now, let me tell you a little bit about it. In 2001, that Supreme Court ruled in that case, Good News Club, and held that religion is nothing more than speech from a certain point of view, and that therefore these religious activities are protected by the free speech clause of the First Amendment. In that decision, the court was comprised of unusually outspoken new justices from, you know, conservative justices, and they pushed this idea of free speech beyond existing precedent and prior historical interpretation. They went so far that the Establishment Clause, which prohibits government endorsing or funding of an establishment of religion, has been effectively undermined. And in doing so, I believe that the delicate balance between the Establishment Clause and the Free Speech Clause, which are the first, Free Exercise Clause, which are the first two clauses of our First Amendment, has been effectively undermined. Now,
before we go on there,
sure.
You're starting to mention these constitutional clauses.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
if I may, let me put them in context. The First Amendment reads, and I think I'm quoting verbatim, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion mm-hmm. or prohibiting the free exercise thereof.
Indeed.
Those two together are called the religion clauses. The first is the establishment clause. The second is the free exercise clause.
Right.
And those sometimes come into tension when in given cases and given circumstances. But then it goes on to say, nor infringe the freedom of speech.
Yes.
Or of the press. And so what you're saying is that in a case that initially would have been evaluated under the Establishment Clause, where the court's going to be concerned that a public school is not endorsing any particular religious belief, the court instead decided to look at the Good News Club case as a free speech case and said that what was paramount here was the free speech rights of all groups, including religious groups.
Yes, the religious right tries to argue that what they're doing in the instance of these religious clubs is just speech from a certain point of view. They try to say this is an issue of the freedom of speech. But in my view, this isn't a speech issue. It's about the role of religion in government. It's not stopping people from praying or having their religion or anything like that. It's really about compelling other people to take a stand on religion in government institutions and promoting, using public institutions to promote their form of religion.
Okay, now let me just make sure I understand your position on this. Now, clearly, if this sort of activity went on during the school day, it would violate the Establishment Clause, and the court's been very clear on that. You can't proselytize to a captive audience of impressionable young children during the school day. But what makes the Good News Club decision different is that it's done after school hours, and so the court has said that that's not coercive, and that instead we need to look at it as a free speech issue. But and that's what you take issue with, is you think that any religious practice within a public building, certainly within a public school building, especially perhaps an elementary school building with little children.
Specifically an elementary public school building. I think the situation is very different when you're talking about student-led clubs in the public middle or high school level. But little kids are very impressionable. There are some people, I can't speak as you know, personally about this because I wasn't raised in fundamentalism, but many people who are raised in sort of fundamentalist Christianity say that they believe that this kind of religious teaching, which has such heavy emphasis on sin and punishment and hell, is actually a form of, could be construed as abusive towards children. So it does raise a kind of interesting concern. One lesson plan that I looked at, for instance, I looked at all their lesson plans.
That is very, very interesting. I mean, we've set up this this duality or this, oh, I hate to use this term, but it seems to fit here, this dichotomy, this two-part analysis, where if the court looks at it as a free speech issue, then they come out the way they came out, which is that everybody has the same right to free speech and the government can't regulate content. If they look at it as an Establishment Clause issue, well, then, you know, your position is likely going to prevail because you've got at least the appearance of the government through the school endorsing a particular religion, especially if that's the only sectarian program that's run at that particular school. Mm-hmm. But now you've introduced something else in here that's very interesting, and that is the idea that certain types of speech might be considered abusive. And scaring children with...
Frightening, a little frightening to children. I looked at this
Then you have a public safety issue, and then you introduce the concept of in loco parentis and the school. But it's very problematic to do that because, of course, those sorts of concepts, hell, the devil, demons, punishment, those are very much a part of many religions.
Well,
exactly. So we got at least three different concepts going on here, and your basic disagreement is that we shouldn't look at this as speech. We should look at it as an establishment, and moreover, as something that may be harmful to some children.
Well, I don't speak as much to the harmful issue, but there are people who have kind of done studies of that of their 5-year curriculum, who make that argument. My issue is really, I wouldn't support this if it was any religious group doing it. I agree with Ulysses Grant, who articulated the conclusion that many people had drawn already concerning religion and school struggles. And he said, leave the matter of religion to the family altar, the church, and the private school supported entirely by private contributions. Keep the church and state forever separate. This is my position about keeping church and religion and school separate is one that has been articulated so many times by so many people in our history. If you look at the history of the public schools, even back in the very beginning, as in the early 19th century, when the public schools began to be established, the Congregationalists, who are sort of the dominant faith there, started to try to get control of these new schools, and other, you know, Unitarians, less numerous denominations, Unitarians, Episcopalians, were very unhappy with this. The situation became so fraught that Horace Mann, who was the first secretary of the Massachusetts Board of Education, he declared that public schools should be non-sectarian.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with author and journalist Catherine Stewart about her new book, The Good News Club, and how she came to write it. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll return to our discussion with Catherine Stewart. Stay tuned. Once again, into our studio strides the quiz guy.
Hey, Stuart, how are you?
I'm doing well, Doug. How the heck are you today?
Oh, I'm doing fantastic.
Tremendous. Well, tell me what sort of question you got today.
Well, this is a fun one. It's about division.
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 Well, I didn't realize that was in the Constitution.
Not calculus, not algebra, but division.
Well, I'm looking forward to this one. Do we have someone on the phone who's good at math?
We do, and I'm okay at math. I wouldn't call myself a mathematician.
All right. He's okay. Well, who are you?
I'm Dan Adler, and I am from Fort Myers, Florida.
Fort Myers, Florida. And Dan is no mathematician, but he says he's pretty good at math. So, Doug, what do you got for him?
Well, you know, math was one of the things that was driving this decision, Daniel. Welcome. But it's really not about math, per se.
Okay.
So here's the question. The decision to divide Congress into two houses, with equal representation in one and proportional representation in the other, was called, was it A, the New York Compromise, B, the New Jersey Plan, C, the Great Compromise, or D, the Virginia Plan?
So this is where people who wanted proportional representation, and that is the larger states in terms of population, compromised with states that wanted state-by-state regulation, which was the smaller states. Because that was one of the great issues dividing the Constitutional Convention, is who basically who's going to have the power, the large states or the small states or some combination of them.
Yep, representation, and it did come down to math. Who got the most votes?
Exactly. So, yeah, it is. It is a mathematical question. All voting is mathematical. Okay, so that's what we're talking about. So what was the compromise that resulted in our current system called? What was it called? Were there choices?
As a law student in Virginia, I know that James Madison supported bicameralism in the legislature.
Okay.
So just with process of elimination, I'm going to say the Virginia plan.
Well, wait. You haven't eliminated anything yet. By process of elimination, we have to go through
in my head.
Oh, in your head. Okay. Well,
yeah.
But I want to hear it out loud because I want everybody to have a chance to share your analysis. So you're thinking it's a Virginia plan.
Yeah.
Because of James Madison of Virginia. Okay. But what are the other choices, Doug?
The other choices were, let me just run through them. A, the New York Compromise.
Okay. Was it the New York Compromise, Dan?
B.
I don't think so.
Okay, good.
Okay.
B, the New Jersey Plan. C, the Great Compromise. Or D, the Virginia Plan.
Okay. So the ones you haven't chosen of the remaining ones are the New Jersey Plan or the Great Compromise. And you don't think it's either of those two?
I'm going to stick with Virginia Plan.
And you're not going to share any of your analysis. It's just, I like James Madison, it's Virginia, that's it.
Oh, no, well, I mean, he's supported bicameralism in the legislature. So, I mean, just from my studies with James Madison, I drive by there all the time when I'm heading up 81 up to D.C., so I've done my studies on him a little bit.
Okay, well, if that's your answer, if we can't talk you out of it, Doug, how did Dan do?
Well, first of all, let me just say that this once again affirms the fact that anytime someone's from Virginia, they assume it must be Virginia in the answer. Representing well. No, in fact, it is the Great Compromise.
Oh, Dan, I'm sorry.
Sometimes called the Connecticut Compromise.
Yes, I was actually looking for the Connecticut Compromise, but it is also called the Great Compromise.
Yeah, the Roger Sherman and Oliver Ellsworth, you know, they had at the convention, 1787, they had gone back and forth about really how to set these things up. And it is the math that matters here.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that the Senate itself will be, you know, for every state, not proportional.
Right.
But the smaller states, they really needed that in the Senate. The larger states, because their population was so high, they wanted more proportional representation. And that's how we got the House with as many House members as we have today.
Right. Actually, Madison's Virginia plan originally called for, at least Madison originally proposed and fought for proportional representation, because as a Virginian and as someone who, you know, felt it should be basically, you know, a democratic system, at least in terms of electing representatives, favored that. But New Jersey favored state by state, because New Jersey is a small state. It's geographically small. It's hemmed in by other states in the Atlantic Ocean. It knew it wasn't going to get much bigger, at least compared to the other states. So it wanted state by state voting. And so the Connecticut people engineered this compromise that ultimately saved the day. And that was probably the single biggest compromise of the entire convention. But Dan, I want to give you a little bit of props here, because you're also right. Madison started out very strongly wanting proportional representation. And he fought for it. But when ultimately he had to compromise, he compromised.
Yeah.
And so ultimately he was in favor of bicameralism. And so you were correct in that regard. It was just when in Madison's trajectory, or when during the convention, did he do this? And so, you know, you were very close to getting a T-shirt, but you didn't quite get it.
Okay. Close, but no cigar.
But, you know, you do get a copy of the document that Madison championed. You get a copy of the Constitution from James Madison's Montpelier.
All right, rock on. I appreciate it.
Rock on, too. Thanks, Dan. We appreciate you. Thanks, Doug.
You bet, Stuart. Hey, Daniel, congratulations. And, you know, Stuart, as always, it's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with journalist and author Catherine Stewart all about her new book, The Good News Club. It's all about an organization that's called The Good News Club that puts on religious education classes at public schools, but after regular school hours. This makes it constitutional. In fact, there's a very famous Supreme Court case called the Good News Club case. Catherine Stewart doesn't like it much. Before the break, Catherine and I were discussing the history of public education in the United States, and specifically a fellow you may have heard of named Horace Mann. Now, he was up in Massachusetts, and he came up with the idea that public education should be non-sectarian. However, non-sectarian, back when Horace Mann was around, was still a decidedly Protestant concept.
Which is to say that they should restrict their teachings to commonly shared Protestant values, which he was a Unitarian. He thought these values could be taught without offending any sectarian sensibilities. And that kind of thinking reigned in the U.S. for many years, and it was fine until Catholics started to immigrate in large numbers.
Oh, no, not those bad Catholics.
Oh, it was amazingly, at that time, public school textbooks were filled with incredibly bigoted descriptions of Catholics and racist characterizations of the Irish, and the Pope and his clergy were described as libertine and parasitical and bigoted and hypocritical. And this was happening in public schools. And of course, Catholics were naturally reluctant to educate their children in these kinds of undermining stereotypes. And things got very, very heated. And nativist Protestants were very upset about the infusion of Catholic children in public schools and forbade them from reading from their version of the Bible. And things got so heated in Philadelphia in the summer of 1944. Protestants and
Excuse
Catholics...
Excuse me for correcting you, but I think you meant 1844.
1844. I'm so sorry. In the summer of 1844.
1944 would have been a little bit
no, that,
even more
shocking. No, I apologize
shocking.
For that. It's just, well, they started to riot and people died in the streets over the issue of religion in public schools. And after the bodies were buried and the dust settled, Catholic leaders decided the public school system was really something that they couldn't support or put their children into. And so they began to invest very heavily in parochial schools. And this happened in Boston. It happened in Cincinnati. It happened all over in Maine, all over the country.
Before we leave Philadelphia, Catherine, I just happen to have written a little bit
sure.
on the subject and including some description of the Bible riots. My reaction to the Bible riots is that it's misnamed. The Bible riots actually involved artillery. They involved large numbers of people. They involved burning down churches and
Indeed.
And housing. entire sections of the city of Philadelphia were in flames during this time, and there were actually two different riots in 1844, one in the spring and then one in the summer. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of it, it was only put down when the governor, after repeated calls, called out the Pennsylvania militia.
Yes.
That's how they stopped this. So I've always referred to them, at least myself, as the Bible Wars.
Yes.
And you're right. I mean, this can be a remarkably divisive issue in the public schools.
Yes, they are. They are very divisive. And I think as we see from our history, that when one form of religion tries to use a public institution, they try to commandeer the public's an institution, the public schools, for the promotion of their sectarian beliefs, it divides community. And it, in fact, I think, produces the consequences against which that establishment clause and was intended to defend. The very First Amendment was intended to defend. And when we talk about, when we conflate religion with speech, look, we have the free exercise clause, we have the establishment clause, and we have the free speech clause. These are three distinct clauses. And I don't think our founding fathers intended to insert superfluous clauses into our First Amendment of our Constitution. I think religion is treated as a separate category for a reason.
Well, that's a very interesting way to look at it. And I'm reminded that there are some ongoing battles in, I think it's New York State, especially New York City, with not specifically with the Good News Club, but I think there are a number of small startup churches who come to Manhattan or other parts of New York City, and then they say, well, real estate's too expensive here. We would like to set up our church services in a local high school cafeteria.
I'm so glad you brought that up. You know what's really interesting? A lot of them are not small startup churches. They're church plants from very large organizations. Now, I want to tell you a story. My husband got a fellowship in New York City. So we moved our family to New York after having lived in Santa Barbara. And the first Sunday after the school year began, I looked out my window. We actually had an apartment literally across the street from the school, a public elementary school in New York. And I saw a group of people gathered in front of the door. And I realized that our public school was now being used on Sundays as an evangelical church, specifically part of a religious network called the New Apostolic Reformation. It was called Morningside. It's really embarrassing. I can't remember. But it was a plant from a very large religious denomination that is part of the New Apostolic Reformation. It's a kind of network of charismatic churches.
So you're saying that there was a large conservative Christian church that was essentially treating you like you were to be evangelized. They're sending missionaries out to convert all you wicked people in New York.
Exactly. Exactly. It was really amazing. So I decided to attend the service in our church. And I sat in my children's auditorium, and there were children had their photographs and their names on pieces of paper and their artwork all over the place. And the pastor said, notice the names on the pieces of paper. Pray for these children and their families that they should know Jesus and say, this is a house of God. So basically, here's a situation where I'm living in an area where I'm mandated by law to send my children to a public school where their images and their names are going to be involved in the religious ceremonies of a religious denomination that believes that we are going to hell. It was kind of extraordinary to me.
So you're very intimately involved with all of this. Well, this is all fascinating, and of course.
And I want to mention other thing. This denomination was affiliated with an anti-gay ministry. I looked on their website to sort of figure out what their affiliations were, and they recommended a ministry for sort of family issues called Living Waters, I believe. And it's an anti-gay ministry that teaches about what they call biblical womanhood and biblical manhood. And, you know, people have a right to their religion. They have a right to religious worship. But in my view, they do not have a right to subsidy and, you know, by a government subsidy for the promotion of their religion. These religious groups in the public schools, they claim that they're paying rent, but they're not paying a cent of rent to the Department of Education. What they're actually paying is a small fee to the custodians union that only partially covers the cost of servicing their rooms after they use them to sweep up and that kind of thing. So basically what they're doing is getting a subsidy in the form of a public building in order to promote their religion. There was another, I decided to go to a bunch of these churches that had been planted in public schools all over New York City. And I attended a service at PS3, which is down in Greenwich Village. And they actually had another anti-gay ministry that was being run out of that church that had been planted at the public school. And again, they claim that they're paying rent, but they're not paying a cent of rent to the Department of Education. Department of Education has been spending a tremendous amount of effort forcefully trying to exclude this network of primarily evangelical churches from operating rent-free in their schools because they don't think it's appropriate for the Department of Education to be subsidizing and managing one of the largest church networks in the city.
Right, and they've actually filed, there have been some lawsuits filed. Do you know what the status is of that litigation?
It's snarled up in court. I think the Second Circuit, which affirmed a prior decision excluding the houses of worship from operating rent-free in the public schools, one of the religious advocacy groups, legal advocacy groups called the Alliance Defending Freedom, they're going to go back and try to continue to litigate this issue. But it's really unclear where it stands at this point.
But very much a current controversy.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harrison. I'm speaking with author and journalist Catherine Stewart about her new book, The Good News Club. And we've talked about The Good News Club, which is an organization that comes in after school and teaches young school children about the Bible from their particular sectarian viewpoint. And she's not a big fan of that club, as I'm sure you've gathered. We've also been talking about other school-related issues. For example, the practice in New York City, most notably, of churches coming in and using school facilities on Sundays. It's been a subject of great controversy and litigation in New York. And after the break, we will segue into the decision that brought Catherine to my attention originally. It's called the Town of Greece decision. You just may have heard of it.
Montpelier today offers 2,650 acres of rolling hills, spacious horse pastures, and spectacular views of the mountains. Just north of the mansion, you can stand in the temple where James Madison contemplated democracy and take in the view of the Blue Ridge Mountains. Conscious of both landscape geometry and beauty, the ever-practical Madison situated his temple over the plantation ice house and within eyesight of the second-story deck of the mansion's north wing. This made it possible to view the mountains and the temple while making good use of the ice stored beneath it. Behind Montpelier is the James Madison Landmark Forest, a 200-acre old-growth forest that offers miles of walking trails for beginning and experienced hikers alike. The U.S. Department of the Interior designated the forest a national landmark in 1987. Several prize-winning trees live in the forest. Visitors can observe proper forestry management techniques at four demonstration stations along the trail. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harrison. Now it's time to finish our discussion with author and journalist Catherine Stewart.
Speaking of current controversies, the one that actually brought you to my attention was the recent op-ed piece you wrote for the New York Times about another church-state case, the Town of Greece decision. I wonder if you could explain what that is and what you think about it.
Well, the Town of Greece decision, as many listeners will know, is about whether sectarian prayers are legal at town council meetings. And the Supreme Court ruled that they are. There was a town of Greece where sectarian meetings for, I believe, something like 5 years, nonstop, every single prayer had been, you know, a sectarian prayer in Jesus's name or even acknowledging the saving sacrifice of Jesus Christ on the cross. And
so let's just be clear. You've got a town council meeting. The public is invited. They're going to transact town business. And at the beginning of it, they have an invocation. They invite the local Presbyterian or Baptist or whatever minister to come in. And he gets up there and says, let's all pray in the name of Jesus, mm-hmm. and closes it in Jesus' name, amen. Mm-hmm. And maybe even there's more about Jesus in the middle of it and being saved. And that's how they begin a public meeting of their local government.
Yes, and you know, can you imagine how, say, a Hindu family might feel hearing this? They come because they have some problem with, you know, a parking issue or a building issue or something like this, and then they hear this kind of sectarian prayer. I believe this kind of, you know, I believe government meetings should be for government, and I believe public schools should be for education. I think that no one is stopping anyone from expressing their religious beliefs in their houses of worship and public parks and private businesses and homes and any number of other places. But when you inject sectarian prayer into a society, you know, government institutions and societies as diverse as ours, it's incredibly divisive, and I believe it undermines the process of government governing and process of education, whatever those public institutions were intended to reform for what they were formed in the first place.
But unfortunately, five members of the U.S. Supreme Court recently disagreed with you, didn't they?
Indeed, they did.
What was the basis of the court saying that praying to Jesus at the beginning of a town meeting was not a violation of the Establishment Clause? What was their basis?
Well, they had different basis. It's really interesting. Justice Kennedy said that offense does not equate to coercion. He said, you know, people can be offended, but it doesn't mean it's coercion. He said, to the extent, Scalia actually added to this, he said, to the extent coercion is relevant to the Establishment Clause analysis, it is actual legal coercion that counts, not the subtle coercive pressures that were allegedly felt by the respondents in this case. So basically, in other words, religious observance counts as establishment only if you're basically compelled to pray by law.
Okay, let me put this in a little bit of context. There have been a number of different tests that the Supreme Court has used to evaluate Establishment Clause cases. Probably one of the most restrictive in terms of separating church and state, you mentioned in your article, that's the so-called Lemon Test. That seems to have fallen into some disfavor, at least by the conservative members of the court. But subsequent cases up through the 80s, 90s, and beyond have seemed to push forward the concept of neutrality as being sort of the keystone, the basis for all Establishment Clause cases, and the basic statement of that was most famously by Justice O'Connor, who, and I'm paraphrasing here, said that government shouldn't do anything that makes any reasonable observer feel like a second-class citizen or mm-hmm. part of a disfavored religious minority. And so that's the basic test. You know, if you look at something as a reasonable person, something government's doing, and you say, well, wait a second, they seem to be favoring this religion or even religion generally over non-religion, that violates the Establishment Clause because that's not neutral. Pretty clearly, these prayers are not neutral. I mean, they're extolling the virtues and worshiping Jesus Christ. How did the court get around that then?
Well, how do they get around it? It's actually, I believe, part of a very aggressive movement, heavy investment in these very aggressive legal advocacy groups of the religious right, such as the Alliance Defending Freedom or the Liberty Council, the ACLJ. You know, the average listener may not have heard of them, but these organizations that are really advocating on behalf of the religious right, they have a combined budgets of $100 million per year or more. And they have, they believe America was founded as a so-called Christian nation as defined by them. And it is the right of Christians like them to, quote unquote, take it back. And they—
Well, now, to be fair, I have to point out that they will always say that they're not arguing on behalf of just Christians, or certainly not on behalf of one denomination, but that this same reasoning should apply to all religious groups. Now, how do you—
They say that, but look at their websites. I mean, they are unabashedly, what many people would call sort of Christian nationalists, which is that they believe in a vision of America as founded as a so-called Christian nation. And they also try to, they almost invariably take, now some of them have a little bit of, are a little bit broader in their, in the way they view things. I think the Beckett Fund is another one of these advocacy groups that has done, they've definitely done work on behalf of non-Christians in the past. The Alliance Defending Freedom, if they may have, but I don't know about it. If you look at the cases that they tend to win, the way they describe our country, they have a very particular take on their religion and their views about our country. Now, the founder and leader of the, one of the founders, the guy, you know, guy who's been leading it since the very beginning, Alan Sears, once wrote a book called something like, it's called something like The Homosexual Agenda, The Greatest Threat to America, Religious Freedom Today, or something like that. It's not, I'm sort of, I don't have the title of his book off, you know, off the top of my head, but it's something like that. He's got a very, you know, in his view, you know, gay people just, you know, represent a threat to America, or perhaps the idea of, you know, gay people or same-sex and people in same-sex relationships wanting to have the same rights as everybody else. They really can't, you know, they take a very particular view on these kinds of matters.
People on your side will also argue that it's easy to say that they're arguing, these groups are arguing on behalf of all religious freedom, because members of these groups realize that that at least nominally this is a majority Christian nation. That is not officially, but that the majority of people here are Christians. And
the amazing thing is that Christianity in America is very diverse, and I believe that most Americans, look, I think the religious, you know, fundamentalists, they like to say that, you know, we are Christians, but in fact most Americans who are Christian do not subscribe to some of these very strong fundamentalist beliefs.
Oh, yeah, I understand
beliefs.
You. The point I'm making here is that it's actually quite convenient to argue, as many of these groups do, that they're in favor of all religious freedom when they
yes.
know that effectively that means that in most places, most prayers are going to be Christian prayers.
They do that. It's very interesting because when I was researching Good News Clubs, you know, I discovered that today there are around 4,000 Good News Clubs in public elementary schools around the country. And I started trying to call around to other religious denominations to see if anybody else does it. I called, you know, different Catholic organizations. I called different Episcopalian groups to see if they're running religious clubs in the public schools. I called Muslims, Jewish groups, Hindus. I just tried, you know, I tried to see if there are any atheist groups running in the public elementary schools, and I really couldn't find any. I mean, I found maybe one or two done in a very kind of, you know, we're talking about these after-school clubs targeting kids in the first years of learning in elementary level. I really couldn't find any other groups that are doing it in any kind of very orderly way, and yet there are thousands of groups representing the most conservative end of the evangelical spectrum. And, you know, I think it's really important to point out here that there is a spectrum of evangelical thought, and the
sure.
Good News Club is really on one end of that spectrum, on the most conservative end. They're really the only folks who are doing it, because I mean, I think most Americans recognize that, you know, the public schools are not really an appropriate place to go in and try and convert other people's children. I mean, one of the aspects
well,
of the
before
business,
we go on to that, Catherine, if
sorry.
I may interrupt you, please, there's one other thing we need to talk about, another case that's very important in the Town of Greece decision, and that's an earlier case from 1983, and it's called Marsh versus Chambers. Now, in that case, the question of prayer before the legislative sessions of the Nebraska legislature were
right.
at issue.
Right.
In much similar fashion to the Town of Greece, they were supposedly open to ministers and clergy of all denominations, but the fact of the matter was is that it had been all or virtually all Protestant ministers who'd been giving these invocations for years. Now, in that case, the court, relying upon the history and tradition argument, said that, oh, well, you know, legislative prayers have been around for a long, long time. since the founding, the very people who wrote the First Amendment engaged in legislative prayers both in Congress and at their various state legislatures. So when something is this ensconced in our tradition and history, and when there's no coercion, I mean, these are all adults, it's not a captive audience, it serves to solemnize the proceedings, it's not, therefore, does not violate the Establishment Clause. Now, that was also a very controversial decision back in 1983, but up till the Town of Greece decision, it was sort of the high watermark of what we commonly call the accommodationist school of thought that tolerates lots and lots of religious expression in the public sphere. How does the Town of Greece differ from the Marsh versus Chambers decision, if at all?
Well, I think it is, first of all, preposterous to say that something is constitutional simply because it has been done in the past. And I also think that there have been so many Supreme Court decisions that have tended to separate the infusion of public institutions with religion that the Supreme Court in this case neglected to take a look at. Now, let's look, for instance, at a case. It actually involves public schools because that's really my area of interest, but it's also one of the areas that has been the subject of much jurisprudence. There was a 1962 case called Engel versus Vattel, which noted the indirect coercive pressure upon religious minorities to conform to the prevailing approved religion. And in that decision, the justices recognized in a, you know, specifically the effect of peer pressure on young children. And
is that the difference? Is that, you know, it's one thing to be in a state legislature, but it's another thing to be in an elementary school because you have a captive audience of young children?
Yes, indeed. But I think that can also refer to people in a state legislature. But they were referring specifically to children here. Justice Felix Frankfurter said, nonconformity is not an outstanding characteristic of children. And I think that, you know, I think the problem in our country is that if you're a member of a religious minority in a community with a religious majority, you already feel a kind of burden of scrutiny on you to begin with. When I started looking into Good News Clubs, I heard from so many parents very quietly, very privately tell me how unhappy they were, how completely upset, how disenfranchised they felt from their public elementary school because a religious club was operating in it that taught that their children were going to go to hell. And yet they didn't want to speak out in public. In some instances, the parents earned their living in the communities. They ran small businesses in the communities and said, you know, if I make my views known, people won't come to my shop or people won't, you know, come to my practice or go get their car detailed at my place. So they already felt like they really kind of had to shut up and be quiet. And yet they, and then they ended up sort of, you know, their that sense of disenfranchisement kind of, you know, ate away at them and made them feel like second-class citizens, like less of a part of a community. A friend of mine who's a Latter-day Saint said, can you imagine if we were doing this, it would be all over the national news. I think people who are members of religious minorities in our country know very well that the only reason this sort of these kinds of groups that are pushing this kind of activity are able to get away with it is because they are perceived majority groups, and that if it were a religious minority group doing it, it would be really considered not okay.
But your point, or among your points, is that this particular strain of religious conservatism, Protestant evangelical religious conservatism, is not necessarily a minority. Excuse me, a majority. It sounds to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, your position is that this is a very vocal, very active minority.
It's a very vocal, very active minority. I believe evangelicals are perhaps 25% of our country. Is that right? I'm not sure exactly the figures. And there is a huge spectrum of evangelical thought in our country. In my community in Santa Barbara, when the Good News Club came to town, a group of parents who were all evangelical got together and they decided that this particular group didn't really belong in their school. They really valued the cohesion of our community, the fact that everyone felt a part of things that, in spite of the fact that, you know, there were so many different religions, I mean, public school is incredibly diverse in terms of religion, you know, we all came together and it was this great public school and had great feeling and we had great sort of celebrations, lots of volunteer, you know, volunteerism. And they got together and they approached the leaders of the Good News Club. And they said, you know, we know you mean well. We're evangelical too, but you're just not right for a school. They offered the Good News Club free and better space in an evangelical church literally next door to the school to start at the same time and said, you know, we'll help. We'll take the kids over. We'll do whatever you want. But the Good News Club leaders declined. They insisted on being in the public school. And they want to be in the public school because they know that if they're in a public institution, there will be the misperception that that particular version of religion is endorsed by the school and the state. And that's the value, I think, of a lot of these groups pushing prayer in public institutions, prayer in town council meetings, and these religious groups in public elementary schools.
Well, Catherine, you make a very lucid case, but I'm afraid you're losing now, aren't you?
Oh, and indeed. Yes, but you know, it's interesting. I've traveled around the country and spoken with a lot of religious groups, free thought groups, people who are interested in civil liberties, people who are interested in education. And it turns out, I actually think the good news here is that most Americans recognize, in addition to, you know, that religion and government do best when they are kept separate. I mean, we have a very religious country. And one of the reasons, I think, for the vibrance and sort of diversity of, you know, our country is the fact that we have this establishment clause, which has prohibited government endorsing or funding of religion. So it's allowed all versions of religion to thrive. Another friend of mine was involved in producing a book called something like The Handbook of Christian Denominations. And they identified, look, they looked at every little thing, but they found just an incredibly diverse, an incredible diversity, even when within the Christian religion alone in our country. And I think the reason we have this really vibrant religious landscape is because our founding fathers were so wise when they wrote our Constitution to give the Establishment Clause the very best piece of real estate in our Constitution. It is the very first clause of our very First Amendment. I think it served our history and our religions and our government institutions very well since our nation's founding.
Well, Catherine Stewart, thanks very much for talking to us about this. Before I let you go, is your book, The Good News Club book, is that still available?
It's available. You can order it on Amazon or any of the other sites that carry books. And
do you have a website that people can visit?
You know, my website isn't that active right now, but you can look at my website, which is www.thegoodnewsclub.com. And you can still, you know, see some of the pieces I've written about many of these issues, the church planting in public schools and Good News Clubs and things like that. And I really appreciate you having me on the show and speaking about these important issues. I think they're, you know, as I mentioned to you before, when you're talking about religion, public education, public institutions, it is like a perfect storm. Everybody gets upset and everyone has something to say. So thank you for letting me say what I had to say. And it was a pleasure to speak with you today.
Well, it's our pleasure. And let's just hope that we've upset lots and lots of people.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Catherine Stewart. What a great interview. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Nick Rosa. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our Madison Minutes are by Jim Blaylock. A special shout out this week to our friends at WVTF and Roanoke, who operate the Radio IQ network that sends out so many of our shows to so many different places. And finally, my name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.